we'll take a moment to just bring our minds to rest. We all know how to do that. Resting in open awareness, all our senses open, but with a portion of our attention focused on the meaning of the prayers we're going to chant. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through all the virtues such as giving, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continents, sun and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. The Four Dharmas of Gampopa. This was his short teaching, but it's known as one of his three major teachings. Four Dharmas of Gampopa. It's like the Dharma path in four lines. Dadan sam shen tam che lo che su dro or zin ji lap du sol. Che lam du dro or zin ji lap du sol. Lam trulpa sel or zin ji lap du sol. Trulpa ye she su char or zin ji lap du sol. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. Lahi ke dang lu dang nu jin ke chubum dadami ke nam dang roa kunji draki jitsam par tam che ke didaki cha tento. In the tongues of nagas, yakshas, gods, those of humans and of demons too, in the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And the reminder for arousing bodhicitta. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. Welcome to Anne and Dan. Glad to see you both. So we'll do the two wings of awakening. Again, bringing our mind back to rest in a state of open awareness. If it helps to follow the breath or to follow a particular sense briefly, that's fine. You can do that. And within this state of resting, contemplating the four reminders, the precious human existence, we now have all the conditions we need to attain awakening, to attain our full potential of wisdom and compassion. So we need to make use of that. Impermanence and death, that this opportunity can end at any time, so we need to practice now. We can't afford to waste any time. Karma, it is our own actions that determine our fate, whether we experience happiness, suffering, or liberation. So we need to pay close attention to our actions. And finally, the suffering of samsara, or the fault of samsara, is that there's no real happiness anywhere in it. It's all suffering and fake happiness. So instead of trying to get a better samsara, instead of trying to improve our temporary circumstances, we need to use this life to free ourselves so that we can help free others from this, this confused state. And we'll see, we'll talk a little bit today about the structure of Ornament of Precious Liberation. We'll see that each of the four thoughts gets a chapter to itself in the ornament. So now we all know how to do the Guru Yoga section, visualizing the Lama or Buddha or deity on the crown of our head and requesting and receiving their blessing. So we'll take a moment to do that. And now the instructions, I often skip this part, the instructions insert calm abiding meditation here. This is from the 7 points of mind training. So we take a moment, let's just do a few breaths, mindful breaths, or if you prefer, you can rest in receptivity to a sense or open awareness. But we'll give it, say, a minute just to let our minds settle. Completely open, completely receptive, not trying to block anything, not following anything, just resting in the flow of whatever experience is arising for us, and further resting in the essence of that experience. The path is all about learning to recognize the essence of our experience and to gradually learn to not lose touch with it as we go about our activities. So now we'll deepen this state of resting, of inward focus, by looking at all experience, everything we're experiencing internally and externally, as if it were a dream. Just letting ourselves settle into a more dreamlike, less solidified sense of our experience. We could let go of whatever strong feelings we may have about things, knowing it's temporary, fleeting, and not the whole story. And then we turn our attention inward to examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, to look at the mind, which is experiencing our experience as if it were a dream, doing whatever brief analysis we may need, asking questions about the mind, and just resting in the looking. As Ken MacLeod says, whatever question we ask, we really can't say what the answer is, and we rest in that. And now letting go of even that modicum of conceptuality, we let even the remedy, even the looking, even the questioning release naturally, which brings us to rest in the essence, the basis of everything. Just resting it as it is, not trying to create any particular kind of experience. Again, not blocking anything, not grasping onto anything. Whenever we feel our mind wandering down a particular path, we just come back to resting with no agenda. Completely open, completely receptive, completely relaxed. And now turning to the cultivation of relative bodhicitta while not losing touch with ultimate bodhicitta. All of this happens within our open awareness. We'll begin with the post-meditation slogan to begin the sequence of taking and sending with yourself. So as we practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath, let's just become aware of how we're feeling right now. We don't need to delve into anything, but just a general gestalt, a general overview of how we feel now. If there's any discomfort, any distress, then we can breathe that in. We don't need to ask any questions about it or know anything about it. Just breathe it in, as Pema Chodron says, as pleasant or unpleasant. So if there's something unpleasant, without needing to define it further, we can breathe in the unpleasant feeling, letting it dissolve along with our breath into our heart center, into our vast Buddha nature. And breathing out to ourselves love, compassion, complete acceptance, complete openness to whatever we're feeling, without judging it. Continuing to breathe in any discomfort, any unpleasantness. And if we don't have any, that's fine. We can rest on the in-breath and continue to breathe out love, compassion, peace, acceptance to ourselves. This should engage our heart. Not trying to change the way we feel, but just breathing it in. Breathing out love, compassion, peace, acceptance, healing if needed, happiness. And now including anyone, any being in any realm who may be feeling the same kind of unpleasantness as we are. Letting it dissolve, breathing out everything good, and especially breathing out acceptance, non-judgmentalness, non-criticism. whatever it is we're feeling, we know that we're not alone in it, that others feel it too, and we breathe in whatever unpleasantness anyone may be experiencing that's similar to ours. And now, including all sentient beings in all six realms, from the sky to the depths of the ocean, the depths of the ground beneath us, breathing in whatever kind of discomfort, unpleasantness, suffering, obstacles anyone may be experiencing, whatever kind of body they may find themselves in, letting it dissolve and breathing out whatever they need. And if everyone could just take a moment to breathe in that one of our Richmond Sangha members, Katya, her mother is had a massive stroke yesterday and is in ICU and not expected to live long. If we could breathe in her suffering and her family's suffering, breathe out healing and peace to them. And anyone else we know who may be experiencing grief or any kind of loss or going through the bardo. Keeping our scope open also to all sentient beings. And now thinking that through this practice, we and all sentient beings are completely free from suffering, completely filled with happiness. And we rejoice in that. And now we let go of all conceptuality once again, anything we've been visualizing, anything we're thinking. Resting in an open awareness, with or without a support, with the support of the breath if you need that, if that feels more comfortable, or just open receptive awareness. Panoramic awareness, as Lama Jinzong mentioned last week. And now back to study mode at your own pace. Take your time. So I just want to remind everybody that if you want to change how you're viewing the screen on the upper right, if you move your cursor, you'll see something that says either speaker view or gallery view. And if your screen is filled with one person, then it says gallery view. And if you click on gallery view, you'll see everybody and vice versa. Sometimes it's nice to see everybody. Sometimes it's nice to see the person who's talking a lot. So does anybody have anything to ask or share before we plunge into our study today? Our opening study of the jewel ornament or the ornament of precious liberation. Okay. So what we're going to do first is we're going to be looking at the ornament of precious liberation or your jewel ornament of liberation, whatever translation you have, although The first things I'm going to read are only in this version. They're from the forewords from the Karmapa. And I'm going to read you actually the Karmapa, our Karmapa 17th, Karmapa Trinley, or Origin Trinley Dorje. Did I get that right? Origin Trinley Dorje. He wrote a foreword to Ken Holmes's latest translation. And it's actually very lovely introduction to the book and a little bit of Gampopa's life, which we talked about in detail last week, but it's always good to go over the outline of it again and be reminded of who he was, where these teachings come from. So His Holiness, the 17th Karmapa, says, "When we consider the life and achievements of Lord Gampopa, it is self-evident that he was extraordinary and highly talented. 900 years ago, in the snow land of Tibet, few people had such great capacity. Tibetan Buddhism in general, and the Dagpo Khaju in particular, owe him a profound debt of gratitude." And we're going to see that Ringu Tulku points out that, I think it's Ringu Tulku, maybe not. He points out that Gampopa's book is the basis of Kagyu practice. But it's also said that all the four schools of Tibetan Buddhism revere Gampopa and study this book. And each one, of course, has its own version as well. So before he renounced the life of a householder to become a monk, Gampopa was an accomplished physician, widely respected not just for his knowledge and ability to heal, but also for his compassion and his concern for the welfare of others. In addition, he was a devoted husband and a loving father, a good human being. After his ordination at the age of 25, he focused his mind on the Dharma, because you'll remember that he was not able to heal, even as a great physician, not able to heal his own family, and he lost his entire family to the plague in the 12th century. So then he became a monk and focused his mind on the Dharma. There were many different lineages at that time in Tibet, and this is really interesting. Some only practiced the sutra teachings, others were purely tantric, and there was much mutual suspicion. Of course, we have none of that today. The genius of Lord Gampopa was to bring together these seemingly conflicting traditions. Having established a strong base in the sutra tradition of the Kadampas, that's the monastic tradition, that's the sutra tradition, what he got from the Kadampa lineage. He then met the great yogi Milarepa and received the instructions on the six yogas and Mahamudra that had been passed down from the great Indian Mahasiddhas Naropa and Maitripa. Gampopa was able to unite these two traditions, weaving them into a seamless path to liberation in what is known as the confluence of Mahamudra and Kadam. Often expressed as bringing together the two rivers or the two streams of like monastic step-by-step path and the meditative realization of the Mahamudra tradition. Milarepa himself acknowledged Gampopa's greatness. Milarepa was Gampopa's teacher. When he predicted that future generations would not call his own lineage the practice lineage of Milarepa, but would call it the Dagpo Khaju, referring to Gampopa. Of the three Khaju forefathers, Gampopa was the only one to be ordained. Marpa the translator and Milarepa were lay practitioners. When Gampopa, following the instructions he had received from Milarepa, settled at the remote Dakla Gampo hermitage, a large community of meditators gradually gathered around him, and thus Gampopa established the first monastery of the Dagpo Khaju. And you may remember from last week or from your own readings that he just really wanted to do more retreat. He kept trying to go into retreat, but once he arrived at Dakla Gampo, people just kept gathering until he had over 50,000 students. So he didn't get to go back. Although it's said that he divided his time in the future between retreat and teaching. Gampopa's own teaching practices became the root from which developed the distinctive system that all the Dagpo Khaju schools follow to this day. Students first studied the Lamrim teachings on the stages of the path. That's what Lamrim means, the stages of the path, from the Kadampa tradition. And then they were allowed to study Mahamudra and other tantric practices. Hence, the extant lineages, the surviving lineages within the Dagpo Kagyu, which are the Drikung, the Drukpa, the Karmakan Sang, that's us, the Taklung, and the Barom, resemble the branches of a family tree, and Lord Gampopa is our common ancestor. So all the Kagyu schools originated with Gampopa. The ornament of precious liberation is our great family treasure and our shared inheritance. It is my aspiration that through this text, the different traditions of the Dagpo Kagyu will rediscover their common ancestry and become a joyous and harmonious family once more. And in fact, the other translation, the jewel ornament by Kempo Kunshok Rinpoche, he's a Drikung teacher. We're Karma Kamsang, and he's a Drikung Kagyu teacher. So both lineages are obviously actively using this book. We should consider reading Gampopa's Ornament of Precious Liberation as unlike reading other books. This text has the power of a direct transmission from master to student. Gampopa himself promised that in the future, those who were unable to meet him personally should not despair, because reading his two texts, Ornament of Precious Liberation and Jewel Garland of the Supreme Path, would be identical to receiving the teachings directly from him. So we can think that we're receiving teachings directly from Gampopa, and it really does feel like that when you read the book. Finally, I would like to commend Ken and Katya Holmes for bringing Gampopa's words directly to English speakers. Though there are several earlier translations of Ornament of Precious Liberation, this translation, according to the Karmapa, is the most readable and the most faithful, and the extensive footnotes will be of help to practitioners and scholars alike. But the other translations also have their charms, and Kempo Kunshok Chok's book, this one, which a lot of people have, that was the bestseller previously. It has a summary of each chapter at the beginning, which is really helpful, like an outline of the whole book in just a few pages. And then at the end, all kinds of resources like biographies and stories about people that Gampopa refers to in, you know, throughout the text that he doesn't explain within the text. So that is what the 17th Karmapa Origin Pinle Dorje had to say to introduce this text. And now we're going to look very briefly at the translator's introduction, which is on page one. I'm just going to read the very beginning of it. Oh, yeah, oh, actually a little bit. The work translated in this volume is the well-known, so this is from Ken Holmes. The work translated in this volume is the well-known Ornament of Precious Liberation by Gampopa Sonam Rinchen, 1079 to 1153. It has been familiar to Western readers for over 50 years as the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, thanks to the translation by Herbert Gunther, which was so welcome and excellent for its time. And it's still a very good translation. I actually sometimes find that I like the way he translated a particular thing better than I like anybody else's. The text presents Gampopa's explanation of the essential elements involved in a gradual, so this is orientation to the text itself, the essential elements involved in a gradual ascent of the Bodhisattva path from the beginner level up to the final awakening of Supreme Buddhahood. Gampopa was a founding master of the Kagyu tradition and is famous within it as the one who integrated the spiritual and literary legacy, of the Kadampa school. Ornament of Precious Liberation, and this is another interesting fact, is the main textbook for the study of Mahayana Buddhism in the Kagyu monastic schools and colleges. So everybody who teaches, everybody who's a serious student of Buddhism in the Kagyu tradition and who is a teacher should be very familiar with this book because it lays out the path. So all of us as serious students, it's very good for us to be as familiar as we can with the step-by-step path presented here by Gampopa. The language is down to earth and direct, and that's true. That's true in the Tibetan. This is like the first thing that you read when you, like the first text that you start to read when you study Tibetan language, because it's the easiest text of any Tibetan text to read. The eminent 20th century, and I'm reading this because of this reference, the eminent 20th century Tibetan scholar Chabje Kalu Rinpoche, recognized as an authority by lamas of all Tibetan schools, presented this text as an enlightened being's, that is Gampopa's, overview of the vast scriptures of non-tantric Buddhism, and commented, even if you want, and this is Kala Rinpoche speaking, even if you want to spend the rest of your life meditating in a cave, you must know Gampopa's Ornament of Precious Liberation by heart. And you must understand also Maitreya's Buddha nature teachings. So those two. And next week we'll be looking at Buddha nature teachings in this book. Lama Jinzang is going to lead us through that study. In this work, Gampopa carefully picks out the most salient points on each topic and, more importantly, provides students with an overall Dharma framework of topics into which subsequent studies can easily be slotted. So this is the survey. This is like you get the whole step-by-step path. And then you can look to other books. Once you've sort of got that framework in mind, you can look to other books to fill them out. Gampopa is always careful to back up his statements or summaries with quotations from the two main Indian Mahayana lineages. Although this is a textbook for Vajrayana meditators, the work remains exclusively a Mahayana treatise, except for one or two minor references to his guru Milarepa and to the practice of Mahamudra. So he's focusing on the Mahayana side of the path. And it's a good preparation for Vajrayana teachings. Okay, then this is the last thing I'll read from this. I just thought this was also interesting. For anyone who has ever tried to read this book on their own, the writing, like most such texts, is not meant to be an immersive read unless one is already intimate with the terrain. Meanings are not elaborated. The discursive work is left to the Dharma master who teaches it. So you do need somebody, like as a relative beginner on the path, we all need someone to help guide us through this text. It's very hard to understand it fully on our own. And Lama Jinzang and I have both had quite a lot of teachings on it. And I think other people here have been present also. Lama Norla Rinpoche taught it every few years. He taught it a lot more in the older, you know, further back, but he taught it regularly, I think, throughout his life in the West. And of course, Sita Rinpoche was teaching it. I'm not sure what happened to those teachings or if he got to the end of them, but he was teaching it quite intensively online to his monasteries over the last few years. So, right, I'm going to leave that. I think that's it. And I think we're ready for the author's preface, which is Gampopa's preface, also known as the introduction in some translations. Anybody have any question or comment before we go on to the today's main action? Okay, so I emailed out, I don't know if everybody got it, and it doesn't matter if you did, but I emailed out last night. I'm working on my own translation of this particular chapter because I'm just not that happy. I mean, of course, all the translations are great, and they're done by probably people better qualified than me. But this is a chapter I've read a lot in the original, and I've studied a lot in all the translations, and I just felt that I'd like to do another translation of it. And I've already made a couple of changes in this. This is just a draft. But does everybody have this that I sent out last night? Okay, it looks like everybody does. And if you didn't, then you would just look in whatever book you have, whichever translation of Jewel Ornament or Ornament of Precious Liberation you have. I'm just going to try to just call it Ornament of Precious Liberation. Everybody knows that that also refers to Jewel Ornament at this point. So this is, I didn't translate the homage, so we'll read that from the book. And I'll read it from Ken Holmes' translation. You can read along in whatever translation you have, which may differ a little bit. So, as we know from the 37 practices and from other texts we may have studied, traditional texts always start with an homage, usually to a deity and also to their root teacher. So in this case, Gampopa says, "I prostrate to youthful Manjushri." So that is the deity that he's paying homage to here, which is a very good, you know, very auspicious deity for us to study, because Manjushri is the, you know, he's the deity who sort of specializes in empowering our intellectual ability to understand the Dharma. So I prostrate to youthful Manjushri. So let's take a moment in our own minds to do that, to pay homage to Manjushri. And then, having paid homage to the Buddhas, I don't like that translation, but anyway, so he also, I pay homage to the Buddhas, their spiritual heirs, the Bodhisattvas, to the sublime Dharma, and also to the Gurus who are the root of these. I see. So having paid homage to all of these, I will now write through the gracious kindness of revered Milarepa, who was his own root teacher. I will now write this gem of precious Dharma, a wish-fulfilling jewel for both my own and others' benefit. So he's paying homage here to Manjushri in particular, to the sources of refuge, to all the gurus, to his teacher Milarepa, to the Dharma, and stating his aspiration that it may benefit not only others, but also himself. He's writing it for his own benefit, for his own understanding, and also to benefit others. And I noticed something really interesting to me, because this is something that I usually point out at the end. I'm going to point it out at the beginning this time, but it becomes really an amazing thing at the very end of the book. The KDC Sangha may remember that you don't get it from Ken Holmes's translation, because he doesn't list the subtitle for some reason. It has not only a title, Ornament of Precious Liberation, but it has a subtitle, which is acknowledged like further in the book. But if you look at this jewel ornament, you see the subtitle is The Wish-Fulfilling Gem of the Noble Teachings. So he's saying that this book, these teachings, this explanation of the path is an ornament of liberation. It's an ornament of liberation itself, and it's also a wish-fulfilling gem. And at the end of the book, he sort of brings that all together in a really nice way, and you realize that this is a wish-fulfilling gem. The Dharma itself is the wish-fulfilling gem. Our own mind is the wish-fulfilling gem. And we're learning through this book how to recognize, how to realize that. Glad to see you, or not see you, Mark Hoyer. I'm glad you could join us. So now, with the homage done, and you know, and the homage is very important. You know, it's just like how we say refuge at the beginning of any Dharma activity. Well, it's the same thing. He's taking that moment to acknowledge the sources that empower him to do this, and also to acknowledge his motivation for doing it, his bodhisattva motivation for doing it. And we all need to remember that at the beginning of every practice session, every Dharma activity. So now we're going to be working with the document that I sent out, or you can look at the preface or introduction in your own book. So I find this just amazing. I read this all the time. I remember this all the time. This is it. This is why we need to follow the path. And it's put out in really clear terms. So he introduces the path itself by telling us why we need to do it, which makes sense. So generally speaking, all phenomena can be categorized as either samsara or nirvana. So that in itself is a very important statement. Everything that we experience, everything that exists in the world, is either samsara or it's nirvana. There's nothing in between. And those of us who have already been through the text know that in one of the final chapters is on the Bodhisattva Bhumis, because it's leading up to Buddhahood. And you're not a Buddha until you're a Buddha. you're still in samsara, even at the highest level of bodhisattvahood, you're still in samsara until you reach that pinnacle of complete unsurpassable awakening. So generally speaking, all phenomena can be categorized as either samsara or nirvana. So as we read the rest, we can think about which one we find ourselves in. With regard to samsara, its nature is emptiness. It manifests as confusion, and it is characterized by suffering. With regard to nirvana, its nature is also emptiness. It manifests as the exhaustion and disappearance of all confusion, and it is characterized by freedom from all suffering. Now, I'm seeing that, like, my own video is freezing. Is everybody, that may just be me here. Can everybody hear me okay and see me okay? Okay, good. Just checking in. Let me know if there's any problem anytime. Okay, so the interesting take-home idea here, like, anybody notice anything really interesting about this? Like, what do samsara and nirvana have in common? They're not two different things. They're built on the same exact basis. They're made of the same thing, and that thing is emptiness. The nature of samsara is emptiness, and the nature of nirvana is emptiness. Same thing. So how do they split apart? Where is the divide here? Well, when you're in samsara, you see things in a confused way. You're not seeing things the way they really are. It manifests, samsara manifests as confusion. It appears as confusion. In nirvana, there is no confusion. When you become a Buddha, when you reach like complete and full awakening, you see things the way they really are. And the whole bodhisattva path is about seeing things more and more clearly. And when we get to that chapter on the bodhisattva bhumis, we see like what each level, like what clears up on each level. You know, there's actually 10 paramitas, for example. And on each paramita, on each bodhisattva bhumi, one of the paramitas is perfected. Like, you finally completely perfected generosity on the first bhumi. And you finally completely perfected ethics on the second bhumi, and so forth. So, but it's, again, it's all like, until all the confusion is gone, it's still samsara. So how do you know which one you're in? How would you know if you're confused? Well, samsara is characterized by suffering. So if you have any suffering, then you're in samsara. If you're completely free from suffering, completely free from all suffering, no suffering whatsoever in your life, then you're in nirvana. And I hope that someone here is. So that's the basic scenario. He's just laid out the basic scenario, like what is the reality of our situation? And the reality of our situation is that we don't see the reality of our situation, and that's our problem. So the whole thing is now about how do we come to see the reality of our situation. So he then does some interesting question and answer to elicit a little bit more detail. Like, so tell us more about this samsara thing, this confusion thing, this suffering thing. So who is confused in samsara? All sentient beings of the three realms. Like, everybody we see around us is confused in samsara, if they're a sentient being. What is the basis of confusion? Confusion is projected onto emptiness. So when we stop projecting confusion onto emptiness, that's nirvana, when there's no more confusion left and you see emptiness as it is. You see everything as empty. Empty of independent, inherent, separate existence. So confusion is projected onto emptiness. Were you raising your hand, Jinzan? Give me a sign if you are raising your hand. Okay, I'm going to unmute you. Okay.
I just have a question, but I'll wait until the end. That was all.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Yeah, when we finish reading through this, then we can talk a bit about it. So confusion is projected onto emptiness. That's like it's made of emptiness. There's nothing really there except emptiness, and everything else is our own projection onto it, and that's the confusion. What is the cause of confusion? Fundamental ignorance. And here, I just want to point out, all of the other translations say great ignorance, and that is a literal translation. And so I'm on shaky ground here saying fundamental ignorance. But in this case, I think great could easily be misinterpreted. And I think what it really means, and I've done a lot of research on the different usages of cempo, meaning great or greater or greatest. It's like the most, it really means in this case, the biggest ignorance that there is. Like the, to me, that means the most fundamental ignorance that there is. So that's why I say fundamental ignorance, but I will be checking that with people. How does confusion manifest? What does confusion look like? It looks like the domains or the experiences of the six types of beings, where they dwell, what their realm looks like, what their experience looks like. That's what confusion looks like. Is there a metaphor to describe confusion? Like, what would help us better understand what this confusion is? It is similar to, or it is like sleep and dreams. And we've seen that metaphor or that simile quite a lot. Look at all experience as a dream, because it is like a dream, is the teaching. So this question is always a big question. When did confusion begin? Like, that's such a natural question. How did this thing get started? And that's one of the questions the Buddha did not give an answer to, because apparently it's not really answerable within the limits of logic and language. So the answer is always, there has been confusion since beginningless time. Just like awareness is beginningless, unborn, confusion is beginningless and unborn. Or born, I guess. But anyway, it's beginningless. What's the problem with being confused? Like, you know, you couldn't, we learn in a subsequent chapter, what we've all had this teaching, that samsara can feel good. Like, sometimes you don't have suffering going on, like anything that appears to be suffering. But the problem, according to Gampopa, the problem with being confused, even when it doesn't feel like suffering, is that all experience is suffering. And we know that was the Buddha's teaching, that even things that feel good are the suffering of change. So the problem of being confused is that all experience is suffering. That's the first noble truth. So when will confusion transform into wisdom then? When do we get to go on to wisdom? Not until unsurpassable awakening is attained. Like, there's no other way except to attain awakening, to wake yourself up completely. For any, so now he gets in. So that's like setting the stage now for what he says next. So there, first of all, having answered all our questions about confusion, about sort of the nature of samsara and where it came from and all of that, and he says, for anyone who thinks confusion may clear up on its own, samsara is well known to be endless. So here he's giving us the bad news. It's not going to end on its own. So he says, so in light of the reality, or considering the reality, and the reality is that samsara is nothing but confusion, the extent of its suffering and its duration, and that it will never liberate itself. Based on understanding that, like if we could really understand that, then this is what we would do. From this day forward, we must make every effort to attain unsurpassable awakening. And I think when we don't, it's because we still think that we can find enough happiness in samsara. You know, we haven't given up on it yet. We're still enjoying our life enough that we're not motivated to really apply ourselves to practice and to freeing ourselves. And by the time we get into a bad enough situation, it's generally too late. You don't have the resources anymore. You don't. Your precious human existence is, you know, about to be exhausted. So he's trying to give us the news here, like really lay out the case here. In light of the reality that samsara is nothing but confusion, the extent of its suffering and its duration, and that it will never liberate itself, from this day forward, we must make every effort to attain unsurpassable enlightenment. Like, there's no other way to proceed once you really understand that. And that's why I read this chapter again and again. So then he finishes up by saying, now he's introducing his book. What does this effort require? Like, if we want to make every effort to attain unsurpassable enlightenment, what do we have to do? Those with discernment, or intelligent people, will come to know unsurpassable awakening through these six topics: cause, support, condition, method, result, and activity. And that doesn't mean a lot when you're just reading it as a list. That's as far as I got with my draft translation. So now we're going to look at the book again. If you're in this edition, this translation, it's on page 12. So he's going to explain a little bit more about those six topics that comprise the path to awakening, to getting out of this samsara that will not clear up on its own, that lasts forever if we don't get ourselves out of it, that is nothing but suffering, and that is nothing but confusion. So he says, this means, after listing the topics, he says, this means that one needs to know, first, the cause for highest enlightenment. That's the first topic. Second, the beings whose existence forms a basis for achieving it. That's going to become clearer in the next list. Three, the condition that incites that attainment. What is it that propels us to, or actually makes it possible to attain awakening once we have the basis and the cause? Four, the means or the method by which it is attained. Five, the results if you do attain it. And six, the enlightened activity once there has been such attainment. These will be explained in the above order as being the following. So now he tells us what each of the topics refers to. The cause, or the prime cause, as he calls it, is Buddha nature. That is the cause of awakening. You can't attain awakening unless you have Buddha nature, but the good news, as we're going to find out next week, is everybody has Buddha nature. All beings have Buddha nature. We all have the cause. Second topic, the basis, or the support, I think I call it, is the most precious human existence. So you have to have, we've studied the four thoughts a lot. We know that the precious human existence, not everybody has that, even if you're born human. You have to have the freedoms and you have to have the resources. You could go back to the torch of certainty if you want to refresh that. And it's difficult to get it, and it's easy to lose it. The causes for like losing your precious human existence abound, which is why we are supposed to make use of it while we have it, because we could lose it at any moment. So causes, Buddha nature, basis or support is precious human existence. We all have both of those. The special condition, or the condition, is the Dharma master, the Dharma teacher, the Dharma mentor, the spiritual teacher, the guru, whatever you want to call them, whichever form they take, somebody to guide you along the path. So those first three, like to give you like a little more information on the infrastructure of the book, those first three, Buddha nature, precious human existence, Dharma teacher, those are the prerequisites. If you don't have those, you can't travel the path. You can read books. I mean, you can read books. You can do a lot without the Dharma teacher. Without Buddha nature and precious human existence, you're not even going to be interested in the Dharma. Again, everybody has Buddha nature, so it comes down to precious human existence. If you didn't have a precious human existence, you wouldn't even be here studying the Dharma. So the thing that could be missing for us is the third topic, the condition, the Dharma teacher. And so there's a whole chapter devoted to why we need that. And those are the three prerequisites. Once we have those three in place, then we can really travel the path and we can travel it to completion. The method, or the means, is the Dharma master's instruction. And so each of the first three topics gets one chapter, the first three chapters. And then the method is like the next 16 chapters, the how-to. The Dharma Master's instruction is how to actually travel the path, like what the path consists of and how to do it. That's going to be 16 chapters. The results are the bodies of perfect Buddhahood, meaning the three kayas of the Buddha. That's the result. Buddhahood is explained as having completely realized the three kayas, and that's one chapter. And then the final chapter is the activity of a Buddha. What does a Buddha do? The activity is to non-conceptually fulfill the welfare of beings. And there's a lovely, that chapter is a lovely description of how the Buddha benefits beings spontaneously without any conceptuality through his body, speech, or her body, speech, and mind. So then Gampopa ends this chapter by saying, this is merely an outline of the main structure of this text. What follows is a detailed explanation of each point. And we see that each point gets at least one chapter, and in one case, 16 chapters. So does anybody, we're going to next look at Ringu Tulku, probably not read through the whole thing, but look at the highlights of it. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Anything they'd like to say now? Lama Jinzang, would you like to? You're unmuted.
So what does it mean to say, when you were saying up until the very last moment when you become Buddha, a complete Buddha, that's when you're in Nirvana. But when it says, for instance, and until that, you know, you're in samsara. So it says, how does confusion manifest as the domains, experiences of the six types of beings? But can you clarify? I'm afraid, I'm sure I've studied this mm-hmm. before and I cannot remember. But the idea is that once you attain the first bhumi, which I thought was the ability, therefore, not to fall back, then you're not falling back into the six types of beings. So, you know, you're no longer returning to the cycle. That's what my vague notion is. So how does that relate? You know, or to say, like, once you're reborn in Daivachen, you know, in a pure realm, mm-hmm. and then the prayer is that, then may I then, in a pure realm, proceed until I attain enlightenment, you know, learning from the Sambhogakaya forms. So at what point, where does that fit into this?
Well, I don't think I have any, like, other information or knowledge other than what Gampopa is giving us here and also elucidates in the Bodhisattva Bhumi's chapter. I think Bodhisattvas are still technically sentient beings until you step across that threshold into full awakening. I think you're technically still in some sense a sentient being. So I can't really address the idea of not falling back. I'm not sure what it is that you're not falling back into. I think the lower realms, I think you're safe from the lower realms.
But it's certainly not like the Bhumis certainly are not equivalent to like the formless gods realms or anything. No. So that's there. It's almost as if they're in the level of somehow the human realm because they're not in the gods realms.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems that way. That I think that's a really good question. It's a very technical question. And I don't think I have a better answer for it than just, I guess my own on, like the way that I understand it from Gampopa is until you actually become fully and completely awakened, and that is Buddhahood. It's not like the sixth bhumi or the seventh bhumi, that technically you're still in samsara. But obviously there are gradations of samsara and gradations of suffering. I mean, it's said that once you reach the first bhumi, once you reach the level of an arhat, you don't experience suffering anymore, right? Because you've directly perceived emptiness. So, it becomes interesting because suffering is what characterizes samsara. So I think it might be a question that doesn't really bear on our practice. It would be a really interesting question to know the answer to. Does anybody have any, you know, anything to add to that? Well, we'll see. You might have a better chance to ask somebody about that than I do.
And also when we get to that chapter, because I mean, clearly it does say that, you know, here are these great beings, like, you know, we know all of our masters that experience seemingly some sort of physical, you know, discomfort, not mental, but certainly physical. And, you know, I know like Kala Rinpoche, the previous, and Lama Norla Rinpoche, and then, you know, that they talk about, well, that's, you know, it's one thing to say they're just, you know, you know, exhibiting this temporarily to show you what impermanence is like, but they also always say, well, he mm-hmm. still has some karma to play out, and that's why it's ripening in that way.
Yeah.
So I wonder, just, and I didn't mean to push this, I just was curious, because I know that it does say when it describes the arhats that that's called a samsara, like nirvana, but it's not like great nirvana or something like
that. Yeah, there's actually a footnote in here, I think it's in this, in the book. Let me find that, because it actually helps elucidate this. It might actually help answer the question. So on page 11, at the bottom of the page.
In which book?
This is OPL.
Yeah.
When will, in Ken's words, when will the delusion become pristine awareness? It does so when highest enlightenment is reached. And that's footnote 8. And so he explains there what highest enlightenment is, but I didn't review that. So let's see what footnote 8 says. I think it makes a distinction between the different levels of nirvana, what are called nirvana. So, it's not that. I think it might, maybe it's in Rinpoche Tulku. But anyway, that is explained somewhere.
It might even be in the next chapter, actually.
It might be. But the highest enlightenment refers to the enlightenment of a Buddha. But even though the arhat's realization, the realization of the first bhumi, is also called nirvana, it's a limited nirvana. It's not a complete nirvana. Mm. And so when Gampopa talks about nirvana, he's referring only to the nirvana of complete Buddhahood.
Okay, that helps. Thank you.
Oh, that's an area that can be explored. And if anybody happens to get an answer to that or turn across anything about that, and I'll be looking out for it too. But I think, you know, again, it's terminology. And we could easily get lost in terminology, even in really good questions that would be good to understand. So you don't want to get too sidetracked by something like that, but it is a very interesting thing to clarify. Because it helps dispel doubt when we can clarify things that we are confused about. So I'm going to unmute John. John, I'm not able to, I'm not able to unmute you. You'll have to, there you go.
Okay. Alrighty. Well, all this ties into a question I've had since we started with the life of Gampopa, because in the book it has a statement here, and I'm going to read it to you. Dharma Lord Gampopa, who has been enlightened from beginningless time, is like Mount Meru. First question was that, how is that possible? And then, which was founded on the essence of the four precious jewels. Nonetheless, he manifested from the unmoving Dharmakaya in order to benefit and liberate those sentient beings who are obscured by ignorance. So the question is, if Gampopa has been enlightened from beginningless time, why did he have to practice, this was my original question, and work so hard to attain full realization by following the instructions of Milarepa? And we kind of touched on that, but that was the first thing that came, you know, and I think this all ties together. And I think you said this, the answer isn't necessarily cut and dried, or that it's different levels of enlightenment, I think you said.
Which book are you in?
Jewel Ornament, the blue one, the precious
the blue one. And what page are you on?
2882.
I'm sorry, what?
2882.
2882? Mm-hmm. That's like 2,000 pages in? Are you looking at a location on a Kindle?
Yeah.
Or are you... Okay, can you get a page number?
That's what page number Kindle has.
That's not a page number in the book, though. That it's on the book is only 300 pages long.
Don't have the book.
Well, the Kindle version of this does not give you page number as well as location, because a lot of them do.
Well, it did. That's what I said. It was the location was 2882.
Yeah, but if you click on that, sometimes what the next thing you get is a page number. Yeah, Kathy. Oops, sorry. Yeah, Kathy?
Okay. I've run into this, and if you go back and go to GoTo, it'll give you a box, and you can put in that, you can put in the page number or the title of, you know, like find something that will identify it, because some of these books do not have it other than by location.
No, I know some don't. I thought this one did have page numbers. I have it on my Kindle too, but I might be wrong.
And it may be an older version, you know.
Yeah, but I don't have my, you know, I don't have it on my Kindle. What chapter is it in?
Oh, it was in Appendix A, but it was the life of, you know, is the story of Gampopa, which.
Okay, let's take a look at that. Okay, I got that. And is it at the beginning of it?
I believe it's, yeah. One, section one. But anyway, you know, I think.
Okay, yeah, it's here. It's here. Okay. It's at the very beginning of Appendix A. The Life of Gampopa.
So I was just saying that it ties into what we were just talking about, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, I would, you know, again, I don't have really an answer, and I don't think this is something we need to spend a lot of time on, because it's not going to help us in any practical way. But often things are expressed sort of poetically, or, you know, in the sense that that you know, like, for example, the Buddha, there's the Jataka tales of the Buddha's previous lifetimes, where he went through all kinds of experiences, but he's still considered to be the Buddha, you know. Yeah, I think I'm not even going to try, because I'm not going to have a clear answer to it. I just would skip over that and not worry about it. I mean, you could always look at it in the sense that we're all Buddha from the beginning. We just don't recognize it. You know, we all possess the three kayas, the Dharmakaya, and so forth. So Gampopa, obviously, though, he had a lot of qualities through many lifetimes. It's one of the stories about him is that he was a bodhisattva back in the time of the third Buddha, even, and the fourth Buddha, and prophesied to become a great teacher in a future lifetime. So,
yeah, that's fine.
The question arises also with Tulku's. Like, if the Karmapa is reborn, then how come he has to go through training? And the explanation is always, well, because you're born into a human body with limitations. You know, human bodies have limitations. Right. You start out as an infant, and you can't, like, have full understanding of the Dharma with the limited intellect of an infant. So you have to go through the training. But it just, it's more like a process of recognition than learning it for the first time. But anyway, that's the best I can do. Jinzang maybe has something.
No, that's fine. I mean, I'm totally good with that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's always been a question, certainly in my first retreat, but, you know, we were all asking that question because, I mean, it always describes, we're like, how can we possibly attain enlightenment? Because it's the same thing in all the, they call them the Namtars, the life stories of the great masters, you know, Milarepa, Marpa. And you're always like, well, wait a second, you know, they already started so great, then what chance do we have? I remember it. And I don't know where, if I read it somewhere, or Lama Norella Rinpoche said it, but he said, you know, you don't want to discount, you can't read it like that, because then it discounts all the efforts that they made, because obviously Milarepa went through extraordinary difficulties to attain what he attained. So even though they speak of them as being, you know, previously, you know, that it's, you can't think of it as, well, they're already enlightened. Or maybe it was like they're already enlightened, but they're like manifest. I don't know. I just remember it being the idea that then you have no sense of, you know, you'll just feel like, well, I can't do it. If, you know, they already came into the world like that. And I think it was Lama Norla Rinpoche. It was like, you can't dismiss all the efforts they went through in their lives, though, to get where they got to, or something like that. I guess I didn't help at all.
No, I think we're all trying to feel our way through it, because it is a really good question. We don't have a clear answer to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's as was said with the Buddha's death, why did he have to die? Well, he, you know, if he was completely enlightened, you know, what does that mean? And then it's explained that he's just demonstrating impermanence for us to motivate us. Well, so Gampopa is demonstrating, you know, the stages of the path. Like, what do you have to do to actually attain Buddhahood? Well, maybe he already had Buddhahood and he's just going through the motions for our benefit. I don't think we know. And so many things are expressed in sort of poetic, or I don't know what the other word is, it's sort of poetic terms. It's like has a poetic meaning to say that he was a Buddha from the very beginning, but really he was Gampopa and he had to be a physician and his wife had to die and all that. And he had to become a monk and go through hardships and feigned, you know, Milarepa's name and so forth. anyway, it's hard to separate the poetry sometimes from the, like, the real story, if there is even a separation. Mark, I'm going to unraise your hand and call upon you. Whoops, I'm having trouble unmute. I don't know why. Yeah, okay, you're unmuted, Mark.
Okay. Yeah, I just, there's a theme that runs through the Vajrayana, which is middle way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And the lower yanas. So I think if you take it that way, rather than, I think one of the things about confusion is that the more the extreme views are more confusing than the,
yeah,
than the middle way.
Yeah. It's sort of curing us of taking things literally.
Right.
In a way, like they're expressed literally. You know, it's like the same meaning of like seeing the guru as the Buddha. Like there's so many layers of meaning to that. And you can get in trouble if you, you know, if you take things too literally, and yet they're said literally. So it's really hard to sort out. Right. And so the only solution is Ken McLeod. You can't say. You can't say what it means. I think that's where I'm going to land. So it's a really good question. I'm glad you brought it up. And go on, Mark, if you have more.
No, that works for me.
Everything, you know, intellectual effort. This is actually such a great question now because it points us back to the teaching of emptiness, which is what this is all about. That you can't say, you know, all of the intellectual activity always ends in you can't say. There's always a wall with intellectual analysis of things. There's a point beyond which the intellect simply cannot take you. And I think a lot of times they are playing with us in that way. So thanks, Mark. Okay, anybody else? Did I just raise my own hand? No, I was just... All right, I would like to read a little bit of the Ringu Tulku. I'm assuming everybody's read it, though, so there are just a couple of points I wanted to point out. So have I failed to mute anybody that needs to be muted? We will soon find out. All right, so now Path to Buddhahood is actually, I think, at least when I've taught this in the past, is going to be our main text, the one that we refer to the most in class. But we will be bringing the jewel ornament in quite frequently because it's just good to go back to the origin. And some things are just said so beautifully in the Ornament of Precious Liberation, like that first chapter, the preface. So let's see what I have from, I think I have a couple of introductory things that I wanted to look at from, okay, so in his preface, we're looking at page XV, preface, just the very last line on that page, the whole Kagyu tradition is based mainly on this teaching. So that's why we need to study this. Like, you can't really understand anything in Kagyu teachings and practices fully if you don't have this basis of knowing how it fits into the path, which Gampopa has so kindly laid forth for us. Okay, and in the acknowledgments, he explains, this book was put together from a series of teachings that I gave, meaning Ringu Tulku gave, on Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation in Brussels in the early 90s. It is not really meant to be a commentary, but more of an introduction to that great classic. So it's a very informal book, and if you've ever met Ringu Tulku, he's a very informal teacher. He reminded me actually a lot of Lamanorla Rinpoche, just in sort of that sort of directness of connection. You know, he just presents himself as this very sort of ordinary working lama, even though he obviously, like Lamanorla Rinpoche, had a lot of qualities and realization. So these were oral teachings that he gave. And we will notice as we go through it that sometimes he skips whole sections. He mostly covers everything, but sometimes he'll skip a section that I consider really key, and that's one of the times we go back to Ornament of Precious Liberation. And sometimes he will expand upon the Ornament of Precious Liberation in ways that are so helpful. There'll be whole chapters that aren't in the Ornament of Precious Liberation. Like, for example, I see Lama Jinzang nodding, his whole discussion of reincarnation, which we all found quite helpful, and that's not really in Gampopa. So I'm going to read, so from the, he gives a really nice detailed explanation of the homage. I'm just going to read the beginning of that. And that is page, it's still in the X's, right? XXI. As is the tradition of, in all Tibetan and Sanskrit texts, the jewel ornament of liberation begins with the homage, in this case, an homage to Manjushri. The homage is considered to be a very important element in the text. It is said that a superior, this is what I love here. It is said that a superior student, one with supreme intelligence, needs only to hear the title of a text to fully understand its content. For a student at the next level, one with a very great intelligence, it is enough to hear the homage. It is also said that if the teacher is wise and intelligent enough, he or she can teach the whole text from simply describing the title and the homage. And I have to say that in Sita Rinpoche's detailed teachings, I think he succeeded in doing that. You know, he spent the first six sessions on Gampopa's life, and you kind of felt like you might have got it there. And I remember him talking about, you know, it said that like some students could get the whole teaching just from the title. I think he's a teacher who can do that, Sita Rinpoche. But I just think that's really like, can you? You could actually spend a lot of time analyzing the title, like the wish-fulfilling gem and all that, and I think it would probably lead you to a pretty good understanding, although you would not get all the details. And I guess the point is that some students do not need all the details. They just get it. And okay, I thought this was interesting on the next page, XXII, still in the homage, the top paragraph. So we often talk about, like discuss, try to figure out what does bodhisattva mean? Does it mean like, are we bodhisattvas just because we aspire, or do you have to be on the first bhumi to really be a bodhisattva? As he often does, Ringu Tulku comes down on the populist side. A bodhisattva is anyone, man or woman, who decides to work toward becoming an enlightened being, a Buddha, for the benefit of others. Anyone who thinks and works in this way, no matter what religion he or she follows, if any, is a bodhisattva. He covers a lot of territory there. Like all you need is the motivation, ladies. Just the motivation and you're a bodhisattva. I mean, I think it has to be a genuine motivation. You can't just say everything I'm doing is for the benefit of beings, because sometimes it's not, even when you think it is. But someone who has a genuine motivation, man or woman, anybody, Buddhist, not Buddhist, no religion, atheist, anybody who has that motivation is a bodhisattva. And he says that with no strings attached. They are a bodhisattva. So we're all bodhisattvas, and we're going to go with that. And I think we've ended up there before. Okay, so, here we go. So in his introduction, which is what corresponds to what we just went over, and we have 5 minutes left, in the first paragraph, at the end of the first paragraph, he says, and again, he's going through the introduction now, sort of bit by bit and explaining it, kind of what I just did, only he's Ringu Tulku. So if you've read this, great. If you have a chance to read it again, you could come back to this anytime and reread it and get more out of it. He says, when one has complete realization, one is in nirvana. If not, one is in samsara. So there we go again. Complete realization, it seems very clear to me. Definitely there are nuances there that still make it a live question, but I think we could go with that as the working definition. If you don't have full realization, if you're not a technical Buddha yet, then you're still in samsara in some sense. And Gampopa begins his text by giving us a description of the essential characteristics of these two states. So he has an interesting discussion on page 2 under shunyata, which is the Sanskrit for emptiness, what we call emptiness. And he talks about the difficulty of conveying the meaning of like what emptiness actually means by using the term emptiness, because people do mistake it for something it's not, such as nothing there. And people really do that. And that's actually considered a worse pitfall than thinking things are solid, when you think everything's empty and therefore you're beyond karma, because you understand that, like, you can do anything you want, for example, because it's all emptiness. That gets you into serious trouble. So that's not it. But so what he says, starting in the middle of this paragraph, interdependence would perhaps be a better term to use, as it signifies that everything exists because of something else and depends upon something else. So, he's saying not that we should necessarily use the word interdependence, because there's another word for that, but that when we talk about emptiness, we could understand it as meaning interdependence. Everything depends on everything else. And in some other text, it might be Gumpo, but I'm not sure where, I don't always remember where, it's said that the gateway to understanding emptiness is to understand interdependence. It's also said that the gateway is understanding impermanence. So there's a lot of things, elements that can help us understand what emptiness is, but he's suggesting think of it as interdependence. Because everything is interdependent, nothing can be said to exist separately in and of itself. Without the sun, for example, there would be no trees. Without trees, this book could not exist. So this book is an example of interdependence, of emptiness. Like, it has no existence on its own apart from all of the conditions that came together to make it a conditioned object. As all phenomena can be shown to be interrelated in this way, we can therefore say that all phenomena are empty of an essential independent nature. So what are they empty of? They are empty of independence. That would be a simple way to understand what emptiness means. I also have marked his paragraph on confusion on the same page. Having stated that the nature of samsara is emptiness, or shunyata, Gampopa goes on to say that its appearance, or how it manifests, is confusion, chulwa in Tibetan. This means that the manifestation of samsara is a mistaken perception of reality. This term chulwa in Tibetan is a highly significant one in Buddhist philosophy. It means literally hallucination, seeing something not as it truly is. Samsara is confusion, a wrong way of seeing, a misconception, an illusion. From the Buddhist point of view, it is chulwa, like a hallucination. This mistake that we project onto emptiness, right? In Gampopa's words. This mistaken perception, this misconception, this illusion, this confusion is the root of all our unhappiness and suffering. So I think I made a note here that I didn't read because I was using the other translation. A little bit of, I did some research on that word chulwa, and my go-to guy, Tony Duff, who created the Illuminator Dictionary online, says that what chulwa really means, or chulpa, it's chulpa, is the mind has made a mistake in its perception of a situation. Mm. One has confused one thing for another. That is what it means. And so we see that Ken consistently translates it as illusion. And Tony Duff says that's not actually a good word here. Yeah, Mark, I'm going to get to you in just a second. He says illusion is not the best translation here. That's really confusion. It means what we would call confusion. You've confused one thing for another. You have perceived something in a confused way that makes you perceive it as something that it isn't. So Mark, I'm unmuting you now. Okay. Okay. I think you're going to have to unmute yourself. There you go. Yeah. Okay.
So I think it's like, we're always perceiving our hallucination of what's going on because of because we're not, we're not directly connected to reality, you know. We have our senses, but they're not as accurate as we give them credit for.
Yeah.
And then
we have overlays, like the senses. But there's something between, like, we're not directly perceiving things the way they are. Something's getting in the way.
Right. And then on top of that, we grasp onto our hallucination, and we think that that is reality.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good way of,
yeah,
you know, saying, you know, what confusion is, or what, even what basic ignorance is, maybe.
But yeah.
Anyway,
I have another note here, defining the term as thinking the appearances of samsara are real. Like, this is the mistake we're making: thinking the appearances of samsara are real and that it can be fixed.
Yeah.
That's like the basic error. So we're at the end of our time. Does anybody object if we take 5 extra minutes just for me to see if anybody needs to leave, please leave. We won't go more than 5 minutes over. I just want to read a couple of more passages from Ringu Tulku, but again, read it again yourselves and study it closely. And for next week, we're actually going to ask that you read the next chapter, which is not a long chapter, the first chapter, which is Buddha Nature. But anyway, on page 3, Ringu Tulku says about suffering, the third characteristic of samsara is suffering. So first one, it's nature's emptiness. Second one, it manifests as confusion. And third, its defining characteristic is suffering. If we experience suffering, this automatically implies that we are in samsara. So if you ever have any doubts, stub your toe and see what that does for you. He says, if we don't have this mistaken perception, then we don't have suffering and we are no longer in samsara. The mistaken perception that samsara is real, etc. The absence or presence of confusion and its consequent suffering is the main difference between samsara and nirvana. I would think it's really the only difference, but maybe, I don't know, he says main difference. I don't know if he means that there is more, or if he's just, that's just what happens when you talk. The absence or presence of confusion and suffering is the difference between samsara and nirvana. I was also interested at the bottom of page 3 when he talks about the nature of suffering. That's the heading of his last section. In Buddhist cosmology, meaning, you know, the explanation of the universe, beings are categorized as belonging to 6 classes or 6 realms, as they are traditionally known. Every sentient being belongs to one of these classes and experiences the type of suffering and confusion particular to that realm. And for me, this brought back to mind Pema Chodron's teachings on the realms as psychological states that we all pass through all the time. Like we can be stuck in a particular psychological realm, a hell realm or a animal realm or whatever, or we can pass through several in a day. But because we've had that particular teaching now, that's where my mind went when he talked about what the realms are. So on page 4, second paragraph, we might wonder what is the source, the basis of these mistaken perceptions and the sufferings that ensue. And you'll recall that's one of the questions Gampopa posed. Gampopa answers that there is no basis as such. All the sufferings are by nature empty. Right, the basis is emptiness, and are therefore baseless, but they have a cause, and that cause is ignorance. So they have no basis. The basis is emptiness, same as nirvana, but the cause is ignorance. And so he defines ignorance. He says ignorance here does not mean a lack of knowledge or a lack of information. It's not like you read the book and your ignorance is over, and your suffering comes to an end. What is meant here is a lack of comprehension, a lack of understanding of the true nature of things. And the true nature of things is what? That they are empty. Okay. Then the next couple of short paragraphs. This confusion is similar to a dream. So you asked if there's a metaphor or an analogy that would help us understand what this confusion is, similar to a dream. When we are sleeping and we start to dream, our dream experiences seem very real. We can feel them, we can sense them, we believe it's all truly happening. But when we wake up, we realize that nothing has actually happened. In reality, we were just lying comfortably in bed. In the same way, all samsara is like a dream. It is important to understand that we are not saying here that it is a dream, although Kempo Sultram Jansan Rinpoche did say that when he was asked. Not saying that it is a dream, but that it is similar to a dream. When we wake up from samsara, we realize that nothing was actually happening, just like in a dream. So that dream analogy, like Gampopa put that into like a very concise explanation of samsara and nirvana. So it has to be a really important point. And I think the more we can recognize our experience as dreamlike, the less we end up grasping onto, the less confused we end up being. I mean, this is like the gateway to not being confused, is to see that things are like a dream and to remember what that means, that in a dream everything really seems real, just like now. I had some very vivid dreams I woke up from this morning. Like in the dream, I didn't know it was a dream. And I was really glad when I woke up. Sometimes I'm very glad when I wake up from a dream and realize, sometimes it takes a few minutes to realize that, oh, I don't really have that problem. It seems so real. So our life is similar to that. So I just wanted to read the last bit. Oh, I did go over 5 minutes, so we're not going to do that. But I recommend that you read page 5. Has a lot of really good stuff in it. And study that list of topics. When Sita Rinpoche taught Ornament of Precious Liberation at KTC, not the online thing he was doing, but many years ago, like around like late 90s, 1999, 2000, he was teaching it at KTC, and he gave us the assignment to memorize the list of topics for each chapter. He thought it was that important, and he made us recite them in Tibetan to him. So the topics, have that framework in mind. Like, he gives us that framework so that we can have it in mind. This is how it unfolds. Cause, support, condition, the three prerequisites. Then you get the instructions, the method. And if you follow that, then you get the result. And then you engage in the activity of a Buddha, which we'll find out what that is. So anybody have anything else to say before we finish up with our dedication? Okay, Joanne, I'm going to unmute you.
If I have a question that persists after our session, may I email you? I mean, how busy you're going to
be? Of course.
Between now and going to the monastery. I don't want to get to you tonight.
It's no problem. Anybody can always email me. It may, if I'm busy, it may take me a day or two to get back to you, unless it's urgent. If it's urgent, let me know. But if it's not urgent, it might take me a day or two.
I just need some clarification.
You can always email me.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that consideration. I appreciate that. Okay, anybody else? Oh, Jinzong, I keep meaning to leave you unmuted and I forget.
That's okay. I just wanted to point out that for me, the chapter that I'm on this book again, the whatever this is, mm-hmm. The
Path to Buddhahood. Path to Buddhahood.
And page 4, you didn't read that, the second to last paragraph.
But, oh, yeah. Okay.
But I don't, we're over 5, but I'm going to go anyway.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Sorry.
When it anybody says, can leave if they have to.
Yeah. Is that this finally helps me really understand what it means by to say something's beginningless.
Okay.
It says, all the suffering, all the happiness, everything we experience now seems very real to us. When we become enlightened, when we awaken from samsara, we realize that all our experiences, all our emotions were in reality manifestations without any substantial reality, without any intrinsic existence, just like dreams. And therefore, we say that samsara has no beginning, but it does have an end. And it says, because you know when, you don't know when you begin to dream, but you know right. When you end. But the point is that since samsara is not something that truly exists, then there's no actual moment when it, a thing, could come into being.
Yeah.
So that whole notion of it's beginningless is that because there isn't something that came into existence right. That was created. Anyway, right. that was...
Yeah, something that doesn't exist doesn't have a beginning.
Yeah.
And the end of it is when it ceases to exist, I guess, like when you transcend it in some way. That's great. Thanks for bringing that out. And I want to invite Lama Jinzong and everybody in the class, like if anything in the reading, anything in the chapter we're studying particularly strikes you, please feel free to bring it up in class. Okay. Anybody else? Thank you, Lama Jinzong. Then we'll do our dedication and everyone can go and have the rest of their day. And I appreciate your patience today that we ran over a bit. We'll try not to do that in future. Uh-oh, someone is unmuted and I can't quite figure out. Oh, there we go. Okay. All right. So I think we're ready to chant our dedication then. So let's take a moment to bring our minds back to rest. Did you need something, Lama Jinzong?
No.
I've unmuted you. What is it?
No. I was saying it was Kathy Rogers that I thought was unmuted. So I was going like this to Kathy Rogers.
Yes, I muted her. All right. Bring our minds to rest. And ready to think of all sentient beings and dedicate any benefit from this discussion to them. This merit may it win omniscience, defeat my faults the enemy, then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangho, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha. This dedication, please fulfill. Okay, I'm unmuting everybody. And I wanted to just ask Joanne, did you get, or are you getting a lot of rain from Hurricane Michael?
Actually, the worst was yesterday, and it was a lot of wind and bands of rain, but nothing like what was experienced by the panhandle.
Okay. Yeah, I hear it was really, really bad there, like really devastating.